This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we need to talk about in this episode include...
Mr. Johnson.
Paradoxology.
Emotional exposition.
And the Greenbrier Ghost.
I'm Ken.
And I'm Robin.
And we're talking about stuff. Specifically, Robin, we're talking about a phenomenon that occurs every January. No, not the sudden surge in gym memberships that vanishes by the Ides of March, but something far more transformative for the tabletop landscape.
You mean New Game Master Month, Ken, the time when we take the uninitiated, those who've spent their lives safely on the player's side of the screen, and gently push them into the glorious yet terrifying spotlight of the Game Master's chair.
It's a transition more profound than any alchemical transmutation. And this year, for those who want their first foray into GMing to be as approachable as a warm sunbeam, Magical Kitties Save the Day is a featured game.
It's the perfect starting point for new GMs. While you and I can spend hours debating the occult significance of 19th century Parisian sewers, some people just want to play a really cute kitty who can throw fireballs.
And let's be honest, Robin, compared to some of the eldritch horrors we've summoned in the consulting occultist hut, a hyper-intelligent raccoon is a refreshingly manageable antagonist.
Exactly. If you've been pausing...
Oh no, here we go.
If you've been pausing before taking the leap, New Game Master Month provides a free step-by-step seminar starting in January at newgamemastermonth.com. It's a series of twice-weekly posts that guide you through every moment of preparation.
You get expert advice, a supportive community, and an easy entry game designed to be run by those who find a 400-page rule book a bit
hysterical.
I was not going to say that. No.
By February, you'll be an actual GM. It really is the cat's pajamas of intro workshops. So don't let your New Year's resolutions be a tale of woe.
Go to newgamemastermonth.com to sign up for the totally free seminar.
And remember, in the world of Magical Kitties Save the Day, the only thing more powerful than your magic is your personality.
I'm ending the segment now, Robin.
Fair, I think I used up my 9 lives on that last one.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut, where we've been asked to meet the shadowy Mr. Johnson, who has an assignment for us. Surely nothing can go, oh my God, not again. Well, the reason we're meeting shadowy Mr. Johnson this time is not at his request, but at the request of beloved Patreon backer Sikander, who presents us with this question. You have often alluded to Mr. Johnson as bad and boring. Could you explain in greater depth what's wrong with Mr. Johnson and how it differs from other kinds of unreliable, helpful GMCs? And I guess to begin with, Robin, should we explain what shadowy Mr. Johnson is?
Right. So this comes from, I think Shadowrun coined the term, but it's basically the patron of the mission who hires you to go on the run winds up betraying you in the end.
Yeah.
And this is something that runs through all sorts of genre work, including not only cyberpunk, but it's a staple of the hitman genre where your initial boss turns against you at the end of the first act and sends you on a redemptive mission of vengeance. It often appears in sort of spy pieces as well. And so it absolutely does emulate a genre trope, but there are a couple problems with it. And the first one, Ken, is as Sikander suggests, it's boring because it's, you know, as soon as it was done a second time, it's been done to death.
Right. Yeah. You know, you can do it once, and assuming you've never seen another spy movie, you can enjoy something with Spy Game or any of the other spy movies that have that exact same plot. But when you've seen another one, it's been done. All the juice has been squeezed from that orange. It's not like a love story that you can watch over and over again and fall in love with the specific differences. In every case, Mr. Johnson is dull the second time, which makes it something that you can't really rely on, I would say, in a serial or iterative art form such as RPGs, right?
Right. And so the first problem with it, as you've enumerated, is that it's a expected twist. The worst kind of twist.
The worst kind of
twist. It's not a surprise. It's an obvious thing. Again, you could argue that, well, the genre sources use it, so we should be able to make people like it at the gaming table. But the issue with that is that premise rejection in the role-playing form is already a huge problem. And it's very difficult if you're running a mission-oriented scenario where everybody gets an assignment at the beginning to get them to buy into the assignment, get everybody at the table to go, they want to do this. And I think it's partly the fault of Mr. Johnson, right? It's that it's sort of epigenetically through generations of role-playing that people who played Shadowrun and got screwed by Mr. Johnson thereafter are even more reluctant to embrace a premise and go along. The question when they're getting a mission is, well, how are they going to screw us? And that is very damaging and difficult. And even if you never have a Mr. Johnson who betrays the players, they sort of have a memory of that existing, even if it never happened to them. And so if you're going to do that, that makes it even worse, right? And so it's so hard to get people to buy into a mission that it's the incredibly damaging thing to punish them for the thing you desperately want them all to do. And that's,
right,
I think, the real problem with Mr. Johnson, even more than the fact that it's a cliche, because, of course, we trade in cliches all the time. Cliches generally are useful in role-playing because it gives everybody a common set of ideas to draw from and build on and riff off of. But this one is about, once you suspect that you're being betrayed in scene one, that just stops everything dead. It makes them reject the scenario. There's nowhere to go from that. And the better job you do of convincing them that it's not going to be that way this time, and then it is that way, the more trouble you've made, not only for yourself going forward, but for every other GM who's going to run for any of those players, or anyone who hears about what those players did, if they're talking about it on the internet, for example. So
right,
it's not just an unentertaining idea. It's sort of a toxin that spreads through the social culture of role-playing and makes people reject the premise.
Yes, Mr. Johnson is a damaging meme, as well as being a boring character. Now, in a sort of a one cheer for Mr. Johnson, I will say that if you are running a game with the mission structure, you're getting your missions from M or the voice on the tape or whatever, it can, because the players have built in expectations and trust, it can be interesting when the players discover that their interests and their mission handlers are not aligned. And it's most interesting when the players decide to be the traitors rather than when their boss decides to betray them, because again, that is an active decision the players have taken, not a passive decision that is forced on them. And that, if you are looking for the story of betrayal and redemptive revenge, which is a great story once, then you can do that, but make the players the active emotional carrier of that story. Make them betray, or in the more positive vibe, rebel against their boss and do a thing. And that will set up all of those great tropes without anyone having to swallow a horse pill contrivance that they already jib at. And that is maybe what Sikander is getting at when he talks about unreliable GMCs. Other, of course, unreliable GMCs are not necessary for the scenario to get going, which I think goes to your point, Robin, that anyone, you know, once you've been sent out on the mission, if the local cops are corrupt, great. That just gives you more people to fight and more stuff to bust up. But if the guy that sent you on the mission is planning to blow up your head with a neck bomb, a la Shadowrun, then that's dull and terrible. And unless it becomes the sort of, at the very, very beginning of the game, why are we all supervillains doing missions for the Reagan-era CIA? The answer is there are neck bombs. That's not the question of the game. The question of the game is go do missions. So if you're playing the Suicide Squad and Mr. Johnson is sort of the setup, Amanda Waller in this case is the setup, I suppose that's workable or more workable. But again, by and large, you're going to have a bunch of supervillains who are immediately concerned with how to get their neck bomb out, not with what is Cobra up to in El Salvador or whatever.
Right. I think that is the solution. If you do want to do this, is don't make it a surprise. and make it part of the premise to begin with. So, for example, if you are, you know, a squad of hitmen and you realize that the mob boss that you work for has decided that you're expendable and has turned you over to the people that he previously had you killing, have that at the very beginning. Have that be the premise, that scene one, have the other stuff be backstory. And so it's not about chumping the players, making them feel dumb for agreeing to the premise that you convinced them would be fun, but rather the premise is you've been betrayed. What are you going to do about it?
Right.
And so start at, you know, that's never the first scene of an assassin film. It's the beginning of the second act, but just start with the second act in order to make that work.
Except, of course, Kill Bill, the best assassin film of all time, when that is the actual opening. So,
oh, yeah, you're right. So there you go. There's now he's got all sorts of different directions to go in. That's not a standard plot at all. But yeah, you can start off with that.
But at no point is the bride being chumped.
Yes. And the suggestion there is never that, you know, she didn't ever, you know, the trust wasn't ever really fully there in the first place. The other way to do this is sort of, well, we're concerned that this department of our agency has gone rogue. We think this guy has been assigning people missions and then sending them over the Iron Curtain to get captured. We need to prove that. And so you are supposedly being seconded to his department and he's sending you on a mission, but really you're undercover to prove that that's the case and to unmask him. And so a job where, you know, your assignment is not to, you know, take a mission from Mr. Johnson that you think is the real mission, you know, it's going to end in inevitable betrayal. And your job is to survive and to document everything in order to bring him in. I think people would, having that as the premise, I think people would be quite excited.
And then in the Shadowrun universe, which is full of shadowy Mr. Johnson, I suppose you could argue that knowing that any given corp run is going to have a 50-50 chance of betraying you means that when you encounter the job, your first actual job is to investigate the corporation and get leverage over it so as to load the dice against being betrayed. And that again could become interesting, although I feel like an ecology like that makes no actual verisimilitude sense, but it is at least, you know, if the real first act is not Mr. Johnson convinces you to go on this really cool run, but you know about this really cool run, but the people offering are Mr. Johnson's, what do you do about it? I think that creates another question, because again, you're choosing to put your head in the noose at the point where you pretend to be, you know, dumb runners off the street and say, we'd love to hack that ICE facility there, sir. And then you are doing a grift, right? You're suckering Mr. Johnson into giving you money and equipment that then you maybe are going to turn against his own corp. Maybe you're going to do the run, but take the stuff yourself. Maybe some other thing is going to do, but you've got your eye open and you know that betrayal is always a risk. Just like if you're going into a dungeon, you know, the traps are always a risk and you just have your eye out for it.
Right. That's the Ocean's 11 variant.
Right.
Where possibly at the end when he, ha ha ha, I've betrayed you, then you've already been through what he thinks happened as the action that occurred on stage. And then you use the old flashback that explains what really happened. And in fact, you've lured him into a trap and you're betraying him. And so the fact that you seemed to go on this mission for him was just an excuse to get into his vault, because you have to be in the vault to hang the MacGuffin over to him. And now you pull the real heist on him. And so that, again, is something where the players are in the know. It's like, who's the Johnson? Are you going to out Johnson, Mr. Johnson? And that's, you know, you could have 11 Johnsons as the title of your scenario. Well, once we've titled the scenario, it's time for us to declare the segment at an end. But never fear, there'll be another Hut and/or segment with or without a title on the other side of this exciting commercial message.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page-turner shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws,
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
A Love Triangle Unfolding from the Turbulent 60s to the Troubled 20-teens,
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene,
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station,
Tragic Love Between a Vampire and a Mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
So welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mythology Hut. This is a very special edition. Not only do we have swans meeting with gods and satyrs running across the glen, but we have a quiz edition. And as you can tell from the variable sound quality, this is a quiz edition taking place live with three other participants, because we're going to look at the ancient world of paradoxology. This, of course, is the ancient Greek and Roman equivalent of a litany, in which the ancient writers would often throw in a bunch of crazy stuff into their books about things that allegedly happened, or as Pliny would sometimes say at the beginning, hey, I don't want a fun ruin, but I just heard this stuff. So along with Ken, we have two additional contestants. We have Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, our beloved Pelgrane colleague, and James Wallace of Baron Munchausen and Ludo Narrative Dissonance fame. And the game is going to go as follows. I have taken a number of crazy ancient facts from various manuscripts as collected in the book Miracula by Paul Crystal, which I highly recommend, and half of them are authentic craziness from ancient texts. Half of them I have made up. So our contestants are going to guess which ones are real fakeness and which ones are fake fakeness. And so we're going to go down through the list and see who wins this exciting contest of paradoxology. So the very first one is, a group of Scythian women called the Bythiae have two pupils in each eye and can kill with a glance. Gar, is that actually from an ancient text, or did I make it up?
I feel you made it up purely on the grounds that if there was a monster that would kill with a glance, it would have been in a D&D monster manual, because killing with a glance is such a D&D power, and we've ransacked so much mythology, so I'm going to go with Robin made it up.
James?
I feel it's also made up. I think partly because I've never come across it before, but also because I think the two pupils in the same eye is perhaps... If Pliny or someone had written about it, it would simply be they can kill with a glance. He wouldn't. I don't think he'd have concocted that extra detail.
And Ken?
As this table's reigning expert on the Amazons, I'm going to say that if there was weird Scythian women around, I probably, as James said, would have run across it. So I'm also... We're going to say this is a Robin fact, not a Pliny fact.
So you're all tied because it's real. You're all wrong. Okay.
Learn something new.
A man whose dog runs away before he is called to battle is likely to be killed. Ken.
Accurate. Real.
James.
It's in the realm of superstitions. Yes, someone most certainly said that at some point.
Gar.
Purely as a tactical team trying to get some points, I will say Robin made it up.
Or points to Gar.
Score!
Gar now is winging the lead. A poultice for an abscess is best applied by a woman whose children have all died. James.
That seems paradoxical, and yet that is the name of the round in many ways. I'm going to say no, just because it sounds wrong.
Ken.
Medica Materia, who can say, just to make Garby the tiebreaker, I'm going to say yes, it's an authentic paradox.
And Gar.
I'm going to go no, purely because, like, you know, if your kids are dies, then, like, you know, you're pretty bad at putting on poultices, so you don't want that to continue, so no.
This is made up. James gets the point.
So I get the point as well, don't I? So I said no.
Oh, you said no. Oh, so it's not.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not going to, like, you know, let my lead slip away.
No, that's right. Yes, you've got to clarify your points. An amulet made from a tick taken from a dog's left ear acts as an effective pain remedy. Gar.
Left ear?
Let me check that again. Yes, left ear.
I'm going to say real.
James.
I'm dubious about the left.
So now are we all.
Now I want. Now I want. Well, these days. I think. Yes, real.
Fake.
It is real.
Oh.
So, and you were real too, right? Yeah. Okay, so Gar maintains his lead. James is coming up fast. Ken, you've got to catch up. Animals chosen for sacrifice in the Temple of Venus at Eryx walked willingly up its hillside to meet their fate. Ken.
Real.
I'm going to say fake.
I'm going to concur and say fake.
Ken gets a point. He's out. That's by Alien from the Nature of Animals. Animals living on the moon are 15 times larger than those on Earth and do not defecate. Gar.
I'm going to say fake. Yeah, no, fake.
James.
I'm not aware of any, not that I'm widely read in this area, but I don't recall any reference to any of these writers speculating about what was on the moon. I'm thinking of it as a planet or something where people live, so I'm going to say fake as well.
And I'm going to say real.
Ken is right. In fact, there's a lot of ancient nonsense the moon.
Well, I haven't
even the revolution of San Asada, who that may have come from.
This is from Philolaus, from the Greek anthology.
Right. Okay, now we an ancient Greek space program.
Yes, indeed. James, we'll start with you. Because they contain a poison, baring your teeth can kill baby pigeons.
Is it the teeth contain a poison?
Yes, the teeth contain
not
the poison.
Not the pigeons contain
well,
the poison.
Well, they do actually bury your teeth.
Yes, yeah. Right, yeah. I'm going to say yes. It's random enough that it's the kind of thing that you would find.
In the sort of Gar method of strategy, we've had some real ones, so I'm going to say no.
And Gar?
I think also fake, just because it's so weirdly random, and surely, like, you know, if you get poison in your teeth, you kill things other than penguins, rather than, not penguins, pigeons.
You'd also kill penguins.
Yes, indeed, yes.
This is Pliny, so James scores a point and ties with Gar.
Pliny, my man.
Blood from the right side of a gorgon is curative. From the left side, poisonous. Ken.
That is real.
Gar.
I think that's real too.
And James.
Hard to prove, but I think real.
You are all correct. That is real.
Scores very tight.
Yeah, yes, this one is appropriate for a venue. We're recording this before Dragon Meat. Britons live to the age of 120 because their land is so cold. Ken.
I feel like that very easily could be Aristotle or pseudo-Aristotle, so I'm going to say yes.
And James.
I think they must have been aware of colder lands. I'm going to say no.
And Gar.
I think it's true.
Gar and Ken score points. That's pseudo-Plutarch.
Woo!
Pseudo-Plutarch.
So I knew it was pseudo. Yeah.
That's from On the Opinion of Philosophers. Back to Gar. In Libya, there's a city called Dionysopolis that can never be located twice by the same person. Real nonsense or fake nonsense?
Again, I feel if it were real, it would come up in a D&D scenario, so fake.
James.
I'm going to say it's the kind of thing that crops up in the Arabian. I mean, the whole idea of cities that move around and can't be located twice. I'm going to say yes. Why not?
I think I'm going to go with Gar. Not real.
And James comes up to tie Gar because that is from Strabo.
Strabo. That's what I get for skipping ahead.
Yeah. Okay, let's start with James. In the mountains of Iberia dwells a tribe who do not develop internal organs until the age of 26, before which they are extremely difficult to kill.
26?
It's
26! It's madly specific.
What an awkward birthday you'd have!
Why 26? Again, I'm going to follow Gar's principle on if this was in there, it would have cropped up in D&D. Gygax would never have come across this, but some later D&D writer would have come across it. We would have come across it in a role-playing game. I'm going to say no.
Which Iberia?
Just says that's all you get.
Caucasian Iberia or Hispanic Iberia? Well, if I'm not allowed to know which Iberia, then I guess I have a double chance of it being real. So I'll say real.
And Gar?
I'm going to say fake just because it's so ridiculous.
You're correct. It's fake. That's my nonsense. Now let's
good, go, though.
Yeah,
good
nonsense. Let's go to Ken. In times of drought, the snail-eating ducks of Colchis lay eggs full of snails, which they then feast upon.
True.
Gar.
So the snail-eating ducks lay eggs full of snails.
When there are no proper snails around to eat because of the drought, I gather.
I'm going to go fake purely because that seems broken mechanically.
This seems weirdly familiar.
The snail economy is broken.
Exactly, yes.
Across this or something similar. I'm going to say yes.
And Gar is right. I made that up. Bam. Next, let's start with James on this one. It is unlucky to sneeze near a waiter carrying a tray.
I think waiters carrying trays is not... What's the word I'm looking for?
Contemporary.
Not contemporary to the period. Sources. Yeah, on that reason, I'm going to say false.
I will say real.
And Gar.
I think it's real.
Yes, it is real. Trays obviously existed in period, or that real superstition would not have survived. Let's go to Gar. People born during rainstorms have unpredictable tempers and are lucky at sea.
I'm going to go yes, purely because all forms of astrology are nonsense.
James.
Yeah, again, this sounds entirely plausible for the sort of nonsense.
Yeah, if it isn't true, it should be true. It probably was true, and they just didn't write it down.
I made it up.
Oh! Does that mean it's not true, though?
Well, that's a whole other thing.
I've met people who are good at sea.
Yes. The next one, let's go to James. The primary ingredients in an invisibility salve are... the fat of a long-eared owl, a scarab beetle's dung ball, and sage oil.
Oh, God. Now, this is a crapshoot because I'm sure there have been many, many ingredients for invisibility salves and salves of all kinds. Those are as plausible as any. Long-eared owls, though. I'm trying to think of the regions that long-eared owls exist in or would have existed at the time. I'm going to say no because of the long-eared owl.
I'm going to say no as well.
And Gar.
I think it's real, purely for the harvesting of the owls.
Well, maybe there aren't any owls there anymore. That's
exactly. Right.
They killed all the owls.
Okay.
The owls are now invisible.
Yes. Right, they snuck up on them invisibly.
Right. Let's start with Ken. To cure gout, stand on a black electric eel.
False.
Gar.
So seeing someone who suffers from gout, I'm going to say yes, because you do anything.
And James.
I'm going to say false, because I don't... think electric eels are
in local to the Mediterranean.
Well, precisely. Again, the problem is too many people. The goat step.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Off because Gar
we stopped on those eels.
That is Scribonius Largus from Prescriptions. Now let us go to Ken. To destroy the love between a rival and your object of desire, dip a swallow's feet in wine and release it in her home.
It's a million love filters and anti-love filters. I'm going to say, sure, why not? That's got to have shown up somewhere.
I feel false, purely because that's the thing that Robin would enjoy doing.
And James.
It has that thing that an awful lot of them, that number one on the list is very hard. First catch your swallow. No, that's nigh impossible. Therefore, it's very hard to prove that the nonsense is nonsense. But Robin would know that. I'm going to go false as well.
And so, yes, it is false. Gar and James will pick up a point. And then finally, let's go to James. West of the Triton River, there are donkeys that scream like men during daylight hours and like women at night.
You know, they scream like... Are you saying during the day they scream like men?
During the day they scream like men. At night they scream like
men. It's not they scream like men during... the way men scream during the day and the way the women scream at night.
I'm not sure what the distinction between those two things are.
Oh, well, if you'd made it up, you would know. So I'm going to say true.
Ken. I'm also going to say true.
And Gar.
I'm also going to say true. I feel like it was in Borges.
I made that up. Oh. So the winner of the mythology paradoxology quiz is Gar with 11 points. James has 7 and Ken has 5. So people, the lesson here is only believe the real nonsense from the real ancients. And we'll be back with another segment after this exciting commercial. In the Spiral.
4 scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Save this podcast from Mr. Johnson's inevitable betrayal by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Louis Sylvester,
Ross Ireland,
Steve Hammond,
Todd W. Olson,
and Andy M. Young.
The chatter of the IBM Selectric typewriter, the gurgle of mid-priced bourbon into a jelly jar, and the constant frustration with the grammatical structure of this Hutt's title welcome us once more into the how to write good thing. And today we are going to talk about exposition, which is something that happens in most writing, not all of it, but most writing, and how to make it not just seem like a boring old info dump or something that should have maybe been kept to your footnotes or your Silmarillion there, Professor. So what do you do to make an exposition part of the story instead of part of the lore?
Right. And so you've suggested, first of all, that genre fiction tends to depend more on exposition than purely literary or dramatic forms because the details matter, especially the details around problem solving. And in science fiction and fantasy, you have world building that you would need to explain to make the story start to make sense. And so let's start off with the bad version of exposition, which is the informational title crawl at the beginning of a film. Often, I suspect, required to be there by notes from the film executives who go, we can't follow this, we need to know all this, and then you'll have a big stupid title crawl ruin the all-important first minutes of a film, and then you'll see that the rest of the film actually does provide all of the information in a more digestible way in the at the time that you need it. So the first thing about, I guess, to make exposition compelling is, if you don't need it, don't do it.
Right.
So assuming you're not being forced to put it in against your will, the question is how to make it interesting. And the way to do that is to give it emotional stakes so that it's not just a dry reading of a bunch of box text by a secondary character who doesn't have any purpose or compelling interest in the story other than to provide the information, and instead make it something that our fictional stand-ins, the protagonist, whether it's the sole protagonist of a story or the temporary protagonist of a scene, have them get the information in a way that we find rewarding. So the thing about the mystery genre, at least until you get to the very ending, in which case there's often a giant wadge of exposition that's a little difficult to navigate, is you make information interesting by making it a reward for the characters that they gather with effort. So they have to do something to get the information, and the implication there is that the character wants and needs that information and cares about it, and having the character care about it is the center to emotional stakes. So when you're looking at a chunk of information that you need to provide, you care about this, but does your character care about it? And if your character doesn't care about it, you have a deeper issue in your storytelling that you need to sort out. But most times, the character needs that information in order to do something. So what you need to do is show them making an effort, which means facing resistance and overcoming resistance. And then in, you know, my beat analysis system where we reveal, you know, show the emotional ups and downs, a question placed before the reader or viewer is a downbeat. It creates tension. It makes us uneasy that there's an unanswered question. And then the answer to that, the reveal, then is an upbeat. We feel good because, hey, this thing has been resolved. Sometimes it is an ambiguous beat. It's both up and down because we have an answer, but the answer that we get, we don't like because it means the character is in danger or their goals are threatened. And that sort of complex emotional tone also makes exposition interesting and something that we want to engage with and we're happy to get. So we're not sitting back going, oh, here's all the homework. Here's all of our green beans we have to eat to get to the fun part. It is the fun part. Getting the information is a reveal. It's emotionally compelling.
Some of that is in the skill of the creator, because Philip K. Dick in The Man in the High Castle does possibly the second most tired method of alternate history lore dump, in which a character reads a book about a different alternate history. And in Philip K. Dick's case, that book becomes a core part of the story itself. The changes are not entirely correct back to our history, so there is still some uncertainty to niggle at you. There is still some possibility. And because he's Philip K. Dick and he's a terrific writer, and you would read his character reading a novel in a way that you would maybe not read another writer's character reading a novel. But by and large, he stood and looked at a map of the world for no reason. No, it's part of his motivation. He likes to stand and look at maps. You like to stand and look at maps, Ken. What are you doing complaining? It's not actually a reveal because it doesn't serve anything that's going on in the story. It just is a desperate note from the writer to the audience that says, honestly, I have thought of what would happen. Please trust me.
Right. So if you're saying the solution is to be a skilled writer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to convey here, of course, is how to be a skilled writer. How do
you can you make that happen?
Trade to get there. Dick in particular, you can tell that he wrote some of his things quickly and that he's relying on his bravura. There's a lot of, you know, generally in science fiction, there's an assumption, first of all, that people are there for the ideas and less so for the characters and the storytelling. And that's even more the case for older pieces. But there are things that Philip K. Dick manages to pull off that you will be challenged on today.
Yeah.
And so if you can, you know, make him struggle to get that book, or have the character, someone is mailing him chapters of the book one at a time, and then he reads them and it shows him how to get to the next chapter of the book. Suddenly you have a more compelling version of that.
Right.
The counter argument to that is this is a 1960s science fiction novel and it's only 60,000 words and I don't have time for all of that, which is fine. But in today's contemporary fiction market where they want you to have 90,000 words, having the process of getting the information be more exciting and suspenseful is all to the good. Another way that you can make the provision of information emotionally compelling is to make it dramatic. So the character who needs the information goes to a character who has the information. It's not a mystery to them that they have the information. So it's not, you know, it's kind of a reveal, but also it is a dramatic scene in which the character who needs the exposition is making a petition of the other character. And that is has some sort of emotional force between these two characters care about each other. The character who doesn't want to tell them has a reason not to want to tell them. That speaks to their relationship and The fact that the information is given advances or changes their relationship. And so you have two people who care about different things, who want different things. There's a confrontation, and the result is that the information is provided. And that, particularly in spy stories, I think, is where you find that a lot, where the, you know, I think Le Carré uses this a lot, where the interaction between characters is one in which Smiley learns more about the case that he's looking into, but also he has a stake in the people he's talking to and learns about them as people, and he learns about his own life because of their relationship to that.
And you brought up the mystery genre, and in the mystery genre is the masterpiece of revealing information in a dramatic form, or ideally it is, because it is all about gathering information, and the detective often gathers the information in the course of a seemingly other pursuit. Either the detective is being disingenuous and just talking to the suspect, or it's a conversation that we, the reader, are picking up on information that is dropped in the course of it. And the information that is dropped accidentally or secondarily or as a side note is more interesting because it has to be a side note to something that hopefully is interesting. The sort of the bad version of this is the old, as you know, Bob moment, where a character will just say, but you're my brother. How can you say that? And it's like, oh God, no one has ever said that in the history of brothers. And you have to figure out a better way to get that information across. And the worst, you know, it gets even worse when instead of you're my brother, how can you say that? It's, but the Kaiser won World War I. How can you say that? Yes. That's even worse.
As fellow astronauts, we both know that. And this is the most deadly form of exposition, and one in which both characters are already informed and the writer needs to inform the reader. And so for that, you need to find some other way of getting that information and just having them baldly say things to each other that they never would in order to make story points has always been a problem, and I think is even more a problem today because we've seen it so many times and it doesn't work so well. So you need to find some other way of conveying that information. So for example, let's say that you need to tell the reader that the Kaiser won World War I, but both the characters know it. Well, have a confrontation between the characters and have a dramatic thing in which they both know that, but it comes up in the course of their argument. So it's not, as you know, the Kaiser won World War I, but I've never forgiven you for betraying our father and revealing his role in the Kaiser's victory in World War I.
Yeah.
And you might not put it quite that baldly, but that's the example.
That
and so,
moves us down the road towards the good version of that, which is that you provide the drama that the story would be about, even if it were a straight up normal modern day story, a present day normal universe story. And then within that drama, in the same way that you might have elements of what's going on. Oh, we're sitting in the coffee shop. Look, there's, you know, posters on the wall. One of the posters is for the German Imperial Moon Colony. And you can sort of drop that in the way that you might drop in, it's a poster from a David Bowie concert or whatever. And you could be able to present that kind of information as a, not even a beat in your system, but like a nugget that you pick up on the way to the actual beat, which is whatever these characters are arguing about in the coffee shop.
Right. It's especially unforgivable to do, as you know, the Kaiser won World War I in dialogue on the written page.
Yes.
You can just have the character think, I thought, you know, year four of the Kaiser's regime would be better, but it's starting to look worse. Mm-hmm. And that's easy to do it. Shift it to internal monologue. The difficulty comes in dramatic forms, in teleplay or screenplay or whatever, where you have to convey it in some way. But as you suggest, there's lots of visual ways to do that. And the final note I would add is that if you are using a mystery or genre setup where the character gathering information is part of the action, make sure that the character cares. That either the character cares about their mission, or that the person who's providing the information possibly cares more than the hearer, and later they will come to care. This may seem like an obvious point, Ken, but I can't tell you how many mystery novels in particular that I abandon partway through because it's clear that the protagonist does not care about solving the mystery. And often that is the case that the writer is bored with serving up mysteries and just wants to tell stories about this character and is tired of the hard work of constructing mysteries. But, you know, don't do that. Remind yourself always that the character has to really care, right? Even iconic heroes who restore order to the universe by again and again and again solving problems, including gathering information, they do that because that is central to their essence. The threat of not having information in the right order is a source of a spiritual pain to them. And they've, you know, Batman really wants to catch the Joker. Batman isn't like, oh no, the Joker again. Oh, well. And so that is like the bedrock, most obvious part of storytelling is care about your story and have the protagonist or protagonists care about what they're doing, which it's absurd to have to give that as advice, except I see it all the time in particularly in serial genre fiction.
And actually, one of the masters of that was Conan Doyle, because Sherlock Holmes's character is this sort of, you know, he reverts to indolence when he's not on the job, and then it's hard for him to get back out of it. Nero Wolfe is maybe even a better example, but the process of interesting the detective is presented so cunningly and cleverly by Doyle and by Stout that that is what gets the reader hooked. And then the reader is rooting, get out of your chair, Nero Wolfe, send Archie to solve the problem. Archie, in this case, is the viewpoint character who tells him to do it. Usually Watson has fallen for the client. If it's a girl client, provides the same motivation. But the notion that providing the backstory as a way to motivate the main character can work surprisingly well, even if, as my Nero Wolfe example shows, it can be kind of formulaic if you read all 34 of them in a row. But in every individual case, the way that it's presented and the specifics of the character presenting it, the specifics of the drama, pull you in a way that a bald recitation by Inspector Kramer would not.
Yeah, if you know the formula, in fact, you have a certain amount of suspense over when is Nero going to engage, or when is Sherlock going to suddenly break from his indolence and, you know, lay out a brilliant deduction? And that becomes part of the tease, part of the thing that you, the reader, are currently more interested than the protagonist, but you know that they're going to be interested and they're going to care. Another thing I care about, however, is keeping the segments to a regular length and listening to exciting commercials, and even more so, solving the mystery of what awaits for us on the other side. The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time once again to wander into that most ill-defined of huts, the hut where we're not really sure what's going on, because over in one corner there's a guy with a weird map, and there's another sort of guy ranting about the historical timeline, and but if we look out the window, we can hear the alien big cat screaming on the moor. Over in the corner, there's the gray alien and the Nordic alien. They're drinking a kombucha, and this time around, they're hanging around with a ghost, because at the behest of beloved Patreon backers Paul and Cleo Bushland, we are going to talk about a ghostly legal drama, that of the Greenbrier Ghost. And This story, Ken, starts with a historical marker.
Yeah, this is the historical marker. It'll spoil the story a little bit, but it'll set it also. Interred in nearby cemetery, this is a historical marker near Smoot, West Virginia, is Zona Heaster Shue. Her death in 1897 was presumed natural until her spirit appeared to her mother to describe how she was killed by her husband, Edward. Autopsy on the exhumed body verified the apparition's account. Edward, found guilty of murder, was sentenced to the state prison. And this is, they say, the only known case in which testimony from a ghost helped convict a murder. Now, that last statement is a bit of historical marker braggadocio.
Yeah, let's not fun ruin historical markers.
Right. The Red Barn murder from our episode 436 is another case in which testimony from a ghost helped convict a murderer. And also, when you look at the legal record, we're not really sure how much the testimony from the ghost helped. But the story begins with Zona Heaster of Greenbrier County, West Virginia. She meets Edward, or possibly Erasmus, or possibly Erastus Shue, in 1896. He's a drifter and a roughneck. He's served time for horse theft, generally believed to have killed his second wife. He merely beat the first one until she died, though not of being beat, just of getting away from Erasmus. And used to say, this will be my third wife, I'm going to have seven wives. So, not a good look, but of course, Zona falls for the bad boy, a story as old as at least 1896. They get married in October and live in, I don't say happiness, I'm going to say isolation, until January 23rd, 1897, Edward sends a boy home for eggs, and the boy finds Zona dead on the floor. And the doctor who'd been treating her comes out, Dr. Knapp, Dr. George Knapp. He comes out and he says, hey, that your wife's body has bruises on her neck. And Shue says, she's always had those bruises. She just ain't been feeling good. And don't look at the body. And so Knapp says, well, she probably fell into an everlasting faint. That happens a lot with ladies.
Yeah, he didn't want those bruises to become contagious.
Right, yeah. And so maybe it was childbirth and there's no baby around, but whatever. Or maybe it's heart disease. You know, I'm just going to write everlasting faint. That'll be good enough. And so she's buried the next day at Sewell Chapel Cemetery in Smoot, West Virginia, where, in fact, she is still buried. So Zona's mother, Mary Jane Heaster, goes to the county prosecutor a couple of months later, a guy named John Alfred Preston, and says that Zona's ghost appeared to her for four nights describing her murder. And an interesting fun fact, Robin, is that in the Greenbrier Independent, on the same issue of the Greenbrier Independent as her daughter's death notice, you go inside the Greenbrier Independent and there's a story about an Australian who made up a ghost story to secure the conviction of a murderer. And this refers to the Fisher's Ghost incident of 1826, although that has also been romanticized, but by 1897 in Greenbrier, they're printing the legend with a vengeance. So she literally reads the outline of what she does.
She finds a plot hook in the newspaper,
exactly,
as it were.
And so she keeps going back and pestering Preston, and one assumes telling everyone that she meets, well, my daughter was, you know, her strangled and her neck was broken. That's what I know. I don't hold with this everlasting faint nonsense. And the locals are saying, well, everlasting faint is a real condition. The CDC has warned against it, but also can't discount the word of a ghost. So Preston basically goes back over the scene and goes to the Dr. Knapp and says, all right, is this everlasting faint or is this neck breaking? And Knapp says, well, I only saw the body from across the room, so I guess I'm not the expert. And Preston says,
yeah, the possible murder suspect was threatening me and blocking me from looking at the body.
Right.
So I just signed off on it.
Right.
Everlasting faint. That's what that is.
That's what that is. That sounds everlasting faint to me. Preston says, well, that's as may be, but this is grounds for an exhumation. So they dig up the body on February 22nd. And the body, of course, shows cartoonishly obvious signs of strangulation and a broken neck. It is not even remotely questionable, even at this late distance, what has happened. So the neighbors say, great.
Yeah, so they arrest him and start taking him off to the jail. And there's some excitement because the sheriff and a neighbor accompanying him run into a small group of armed men who are intent on lynching Shue. So just the ghost and the exhumation, that's enough for them. And they protect Shue by hiding him in the woods and evading that lynch mob. So the local sentiment was not in Shu's favor at all. Everybody heard this and went, yep, that guy clearly, yep, he did it. Let's string him up.
Exactly. But he is put on trial in Lewisburg, the county seat, and this is in June 22nd. The prosecution brings character witnesses to say that Shu is an abusive, wife-murdering son of a gun, and then they also bring the testimony of the broken neck on the body. So means, opportunity, motive, there we go. Problem solved. The defense is who introduces the ghost story into the court because they're trying to make it.
In the annals of great legal mistakes, the defense brings up the ghost story.
So they call Mary Jane, the mother, and they say, you know, is it true that you saw a ghost? And she says, it absolutely is. And we have some of the testimony. Most of the court transcript is gone, but a bit of this was printed in the good old Greenbrier Independent. So if I may, Robin.
And they printed the good part.
Mary Jane says, it was no dream. She came back and told me that he was mad that she didn't have no meat cooked for supper. She comes 4 times and 4 nights, but the second night she told me that her neck was squeezed off at the first joint, and it was just as she told me. And the lawyer says,
and this was not a dream founded upon your distressed condition of mind?
No, sir. It was no dream, for I was wide awake as I ever was. She wore the very dress that she was killed in, and when she went to leave me, she turned her head completely around and looked at me like she wanted me to know all about it.
Then you insist that she actually appeared in the flesh and blood to you upon 4 different occasions?
Yes, sir.
Well, I was very smart to bring this up, wasn't I?
Yes, a brilliant, brilliant plan. And so the defense then says, can we strike all that testimony? And the judge says, this was your witness, dummy. You can't strike it.
Wait a minute. I wasn't smart at all. Can we retract my stupid error?
We cannot.
Darn.
And so it goes to the West Virginia jury.
I wish I knew more legal stuff.
And the jury says, well, on the one hand, clear physical evidence. On the other hand, a ghost. So 2 reasons to convict.
Yeah. Her mother is very sure that he did it. That's definitely exculpatory. Yeah.
And so Shu is found guilty on July 11th. And the argument is that because of this ghost nonsense, the jury said, well, just in case we find a different neck-breaking problem child, let's just sentence him to life without parole. Just in case some new evidence comes up, so we can then apologize and shake his hand. But he's at the Moundsville State Prison, and there's a prison epidemic, and he dies in 1900. So that is the end of Erasmus Erastus Edward Shu. And also, that is the triumphant story of the Greenbrier ghost, who may have actually been the Greenbrier Independent Newsweekly ghost, because you noticed, perhaps, that the mother gives her detailed testimony after the evidence of the autopsy has been released. So perhaps there's a little bit of after-the-fact sweetening of a ghost story that may, in fact, have come from Australia in the first place.
Right. So sadly, there's a bit of a fun-ruining aspect to this. And even in the most fantastically acceptable version, the testimony of the ghost only comes into it because the defense blunders and introduces this very exciting sidelight issue. And so the ghost did not actually convict this person and was not certainly introduced by the prosecution as prosecution right. evidence. But let's put it on the historical sign anyway, because that's the cooler version.
Right. Yes. When the truth conflicts with the legend, put the legend on the historical marker. I think that's the U.S. Park Service's motto. But again,
you have to go back to Norse culture to get legal cases with actual ghosts, where ghosts are sued, ghosts show up and testify in legal proceedings. So I'm sure there's got to be, you know, possibly didn't get recorded in a surviving saga, but I'm sure there's a legit case of a ghost testifying and revealing a murder there. That's got to be where that happened, like in Iceland or something.
And I don't know if it was ever legally accepted evidence, but I think it must have been in medieval times that the dead body would bleed in the presence of the murderer. And so they used to have a little lineup and they would go past the dead body. And if it bled, then that was, you know, sufficient grounds for prosecution, certainly. It's not quite a ghost, but it is, you know, a dead body testifying. That's pretty good.
And just like we covered a while ago, forensics has been off for a while.
Yes, right. Dead body bleeding evidence is now only acceptable testimony, I think, in Tennessee and Missouri, I believe, if I'm up on my dead body.
Right. It's more reliable than bite marks.
Right.
Well, on that note, it's time for us to call another exciting episode of this here podcast to a close. But we and possibly some ghosts will be back later, starting a week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep ghosts from testifying against this podcast by joining such backers as
Dave Barr,
Derek Yates,
Ludovic Chabant,
Luke Silburn,
and Mark Kevin Hall.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashry.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.